Everything is fine. You know it's fine, and yet there's a buzz or a hum in your nervous system. It's a low-grade something is wrong that you can't explain and can't locate necessarily. And often it's running all the time underneath days that are objectively, and at least on the surface, are okay. You've tried to think your way out of it, and maybe you've done therapy or various somatic practices, frameworks. Maybe you can even describe what's happening as it's happening in real time, but it still keeps coming back. It's still running. If you've been listening to this series, you already know the reason. Understanding a pattern helps, but rarely resolves the situation. The body trusts lived evidence more than intellectual reassurance. Today, I want to make that concrete, not as a concept, but as something you can actually feel the difference of. We're going to look at three specific things that persistent anxiety most often points towards. And then, because naming the pattern is not the same thing as changing it, we're going to look at what your nervous system actually needs to begin shifting it. Today on Ask Dr. Gill, we're going to talk about the signal that happens in our bodies. Anxiety is not a malfunction. It's a signal, and understanding that helps. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkelman. And today on the podcast, I want to talk about anxiety as a signal. Anxiety can have many sources, and sometimes it contains information about a pattern worth understanding. Sometimes it's exhaustion. Sometimes it's hormonal. Sometimes it's biological. Sometimes the nervous system is firing in an imperfect way. There's an imprecision there because the biology is out of alignment. What I'm offering today is most useful that for anxiety that is, I'll say, relational in character. It clusters around specific types of situations or keeps appearing in the same context. And if you feel the anxiety feels more random or physical, that's a conversation with the doctor, the physician, not this framework, right? This is more around like the Sunday, you know, worries that you get in the evening about the week ahead, right? It's more about that. One thing before we get into the three settings. Something that changes how you relate to everything that follows. Anxiety is often not the primary experience. It is what happens when a more primary emotion, grief, anger, longing, fear, you learned it was too dangerous to feel that directly. The anxiety is the guard at the door. And one of the things I tell patients is anxiety technically isn't an emotion. It's an energetic state. Very often, underneath this chronic anxiety, we learn to avoid feeling these emotions. Maybe there is an unsafe setting, or there is a grief that wasn't allowed to be expressed. Or maybe it was an unseen situation, the ache of wanting someone to know that you were there, but and that you had a safe place to land, but that never came. Behind the unwelcome setting, there's often an anger underlying that. And that's because you were forced to be smaller than you were. The anxiety keeps those emotions at a manageable distance, right? But it's a signal there's something underneath it. It's not the wound. And I think it's an important distinction to make. It's the protective casing around the wound. And sometimes that's why addressing the anxiety on the level of symptom management, it can provide relief. But the guard is quieted, but the guarding hasn't been touched. And often it's worth going deeper. So let's talk about the three settings. So you have the background of what's underneath all of this. For many people, especially when anxiety clusters around relational situations or self-protective patterns, it organizes around one of three learned settings. Each one is the adaptive prediction a part of you formed, usually early, about what the world required from you. These aren't character flaws. I want to be clear about this. And they're not permanent personality structures. They are the nervous system doing its job, protecting you from the outcomes it learned to expect in an environment that may not exist anymore, except in your own psyche. And as I describe each one, notice what feels familiar as you're listening to this. Not what you think should apply, but what actually lands in your body. So the first one is the unsafety setting. And this is the part of you that may have learned the world isn't safe and I need to monitor things constantly. You know, these aren't necessarily dramatic events. And I mentioned this last week. Trauma isn't necessarily the thing, the big thing that happened. Sometimes it's all those little things that add up. Often through the chronic texture of unpredictability, you know, parents whose mood shifted without warning, or a sibling, in fact, that can happen, where there's a tension in the household that was always present but wasn't talked about. It's the proverbial elephant in the room. And in childhood, you may have learned you need to read the room before you go into the room. That's going to create a level of anxiety and all of your experiences, right? You have to calculate how much of you was safe to bring to the situation. And the nervous system drew a basic conclusion, which is relaxing can be dangerous. Stillness is when things go wrong and being caught off guard happens. In adulthood, this produces a vigilance that never shuts off. It's not fear exactly. It's more like a background alertness that runs even in environments where nothing bad has ever happened. Now, often we bring that into our other relationships. So if you grew up in a household like that, you may be in relationship with others that are like that. And whether it's the person is actually like that or you're bringing that to the situation is sometimes, or both, sometimes hard to know. What happens is you have an inability to be fully present to the ordinary because the system is always scanning for what's in front of you, what could be happening. And you might notice this is it's really difficult to go on vacation, for example. There's nothing required of you, but instead of relaxing, you actually feel more unsettled than usual. It's the absence of something to manage triggers this system. It's like, oh, if I'm too quiet, something bad's going to happen. Rest becomes the cue for something bad approaching, and peace feels suspicious. Now, there's also this. You are better at crisis than at calm. Ordinary life can feel flat or maybe even threatening. The quiet Sunday afternoon produces that low level of dread that you can't account for. The nervous system remains loyal to what it's learned, and it keeps watching for the disruption it was taught to expect. If this one landed, the signal is not something bad is about to happen. The signal is that the nervous system hasn't yet accumulated enough evidence that stillness is safe. Setting two is the unseen setting. Your body began expecting something really interesting, which is being truly known or truly seen is dangerous. It's not the fear of failure, and that's not what I'm talking about here. It's more specific than that. The fear that visibility leads somewhere painful, that being accurately perceived, not the managed version, not the performed version, but the actual self, will produce rejection, will produce criticism, or the loss of something important. And this produces a low-level anxiety of exposure. The body that performs rather than inhabiting. The exhaustion of interactions that require managing the impression being made. Not occasionally, but at the baseline mode of being in the world with other people. In adulthood, it can look like this. You achieve something significant, you hit something big, and instead of feeling satisfied, your response is anxiety about whether you can sustain it. It's like if you're told you're the hero, your first thought is, oh, when am I going to be the GOAT? Not the greatest of all time, the GOAT, like the person to blame. Whether people will find out that you're not actually who you think you are, that exposure that comes with the success feels more like a liability rather than a reward. Or here's another example. Someone pays you a genuine compliment and something in you immediately deflects it or discounts it. It's not about false modesty, by the way. This is about a genuine inability to receive positive perception without bracing for the catch. It's like you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And the compliment often will trigger vigilance in you. The last example is the quiet grief, the sense of being known for your function, your usefulness, your capacity, rather than the person underneath it. And you feel lonely, even though you're admired, because you're not seen for who you really are. If this one landed, the signal is not that these people are dangerous. The signal is that being truly known leads to something painful. And the nervous system is still protecting you from repeating that. Setting three is the unwelcome setting. You learned implicitly that full presence is too much. Something in your earliest relational environment communicated that your full presence was a problem. Not always dramatically. Sometimes it was through hundreds of small corrections. Don't touch that. Go over there, stay away from that. The parent overwhelmed by emotional need, that's another possibility. The environment where your feelings created difficulty for the people around you. And you learned to take up less space, less volume. You'd have less visibility. Because full presence was somehow too much for the people who were supposed to be able to hold it. This is worth distinguishing from ordinary politeness or consideration for others. What I'm describing is more specific. It's the chronic sense that your needs themselves, not your behaviors, but your needs, create danger, burden, or instability in the people around you. That you're wanting something is already an imposition before it's even expressed. And In adulthood, this produces anxiety that lives in the body as a chronic apology. You overexplain. You preemptively shrink. That sense that expressing a need, holding a boundary, or simply existing at full capacity is inherently dangerous or impolite. A specific form this takes, you have an opinion, but before you express it, you calculate whether the person you're expressing it to will have a reaction. You feel guilty for needing things. You are more comfortable attending to other people's emotional states than inhabiting your own. Or this one, when someone asks what you want, you go blank. Not because you have no preferences, but because tracking your own preferences was never a priority. It was more important to track other person's preferences. If this one landed, the signal is not that your presence is actually dangerous. The signal is that your nervous system learned from the relational environment you grew up in that full presence requires justification. And it is still requiring that justification, even in places where no one's asking you for it. So these are adaptive predictions, not fixed personality structures. And they describe where your nervous system's braces, not who you are. It's actually hiding who you are. So let's take a quick break. And on the other end, we're going to talk about the costs to this and what to do about it. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman. And if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to send an email to info@askdrgill.com. And if you like the show and like the episodes, please put a like down below if on YouTube or whatever platform you might be watching or listening to this. And as always, if you want to add comments, let me know. They're turned on again. So, all right, so let's get back to the signal and these anxiety and these states that we're in. I want to name something directly here because I think it matters to where you go with this. These settings that I talked about in the first half of the show made sense when they formed. And this is the nervous system's intelligent adaptation to the environment it was in. They were protective for that environment. And this is not that your nervous system failed you or you did something wrong. It's about the cost to keep running a setting that was calibrated in a world that no longer exists. The cost is real. Because it tends to accumulate quietly. The unsafety setting that I talked about, carried over years, creates low-grade exhaustion because you're in vigilance all the time. And that prolonged alertness creates stress on the body. the relationships that stay at surface level because depth feels risky. The creativity and spontaneity that gets crowded out because you're overly monitoring. The energy that goes into scanning instead of living. The unseen setting carried over years, performance fatigue compounds. That quiet loneliness of being known for your function rather than for who you really are. And there's a numbness that arrives around achievement, not because the achievements stop happening, but because it stops meaning anything. It's unsafe. And the sense of being a very, very successful stranger to your own self. And the unwelcome setting carried over years creates progressive shrinking, the need that stops being felt because it was never allowed. The identity organized around usefulness rather than presence. The exhaustion of being perpetually responsible for the emotional weather and the emotional needs of others. Now, these aren't dramatic collapses in most cases. These are things that accumulate the way interest accumulates, very slowly and eventually noticeably. And one day you wake up and realize you've been managing everyone else's experience and lost your ability to access your own. Naming the cost is not about blame. It's not like, please don't blame yourself for this. It's about having an honest visual of yourself. And change becomes possible when the cost of holding the old pattern becomes harder to ignore than the uncertainty of something new. You don't need to pathologize yourself for this. Most of what I've described is adaptive. It's true in most relational environments for most people. And recognizing it is useful and doesn't require a diagnosis. So what are the early signs of shifting this look like? And I think that it's important to talk about this because we're not going to a particular destination, right? This is like a slow journey. And the early signs, the small moments that you can see that something is shifting before you use the word healed, right? I think it's important. And by the way, this is true with most conditions, right? In terms of healing, because people often miss the small things or discount them because they don't match what the expected transformation should look like, right? So each of these that I'm about to describe, it's important to see that there's a spectrum of change that happens. And let's see if you recognize this. So for the unsafe setting, you notice sometime on the second day of your vacation or the third day that the bracing drops a little bit. You catch yourself sitting in silence without needing to fill it. Or you walk into your own home and your shoulders come down before you consciously decide to let them down. The quiet Sunday afternoon that feels normal instead of ominous. It's just a pleasant day. For the unseen setting, one of the first things that people notice is they can take the compliment in. Maybe not all the way, not immediately, but more than before. Or you finish a conversation and notice an hour later that you haven't replayed it in your head. You share something true about yourself, something slightly more honest than you might usually have allowed. And you stay present for the response instead of immediately scanning, oh my God, should I have said that? The performance fatigue starts to decrease and you start inhabiting more and managing less. For the unwelcome setting, you express a need and the anxiety spike that follows it doesn't happen, or it's smaller. Maybe it's still there, but it's not as big. Or you hold a position in a conversation and notice afterwards that you didn't apologize for it. You take up slightly more space, physically, vocally, emotionally, and it feels less like a transgression and more like just being present in yourself. Nobody announces a turning point. People just notice gradually that things are different. And the morning that doesn't start with the hum, the conversation that doesn't require recovery time, the room you walk into without automatically scanning your impact on it. This is what updating the calibration produces. It's not the end of anxiety right away, usually. It's a different relationship to it. And your baseline begins to shift. So the background frequency drops. I want to talk about three nervous system experiments you can do. Understanding which setting is running is useful, but the body trusts lived evidence, not explanations. I want to give you an experiment for each setting. This isn't homework, but it's a more of a technique that you can use as a way of gathering data about what your nervous system is actually doing. One important thing to note before we go into them, the point is not to push yourself past your capacity. The point is to notice the nervous system's prediction in real time. What arises, what tightens, what the body does when the habitual perception, when the habitual protection is not engaged. That noticing is the data, and it also is what allows the system to update itself. Okay, so for those of you who had the unsafety setting, like that resonated for you, we're going to try 10 minutes this week. You do nothing with an agenda. It's not meditation. It's not visualization. It's not breathing exercises. It's not listening to music. It's not reading. It's just stillness. It's just sitting quietly and let the time pass. Don't fill it. Notice what your body does. Does it reach for something to manage? Does a low-level anxiety arise? When does the scanning begin? Does peace feel suspicious? Again, you're not trying to fix anything. This is information gathering. It's about what a part of you does when monitoring isn't required. That information tells you more about the setting than any framework can. If stillness immediately produces agitation or restlessness, that's not failure, it's information. That is the setting revealing itself in real time. For the unseen setting, I want you to take a moment of honesty. So at some point this week, say something, I'll say it this way, more true than you might normally say it to someone who has the capacity to receive it. Not a confession, by the way, not a full emotional exposure, just something slightly beyond what you'd normally say in your default. And then be present for their response. Don't deflect it. Don't qualify it immediately. Just let it land. And watch what your body does in the moment when you're saying it and afterwards. The response, whatever it is the nervous system's current prediction about what being more true or seen costs you. It's data again, not theory. And for the unwelcome setting, one unapologized need. At some point at this week, express a preference or need without an apology, without a qualifier, without the shrinking. Make this something small, like where to go to eat. Well, that might not be small for some families. Or I need an hour. I don't want to do that. Just the need without an apology before it and without the over-explanation after it. Notice what happens. Not what the nervous system predicted what happened, but what actually happens. You see, the nervous system updates when its predictions turn out to be wrong. But we have to watch that to see it so it can do the updating. if it predicted that expressing the need would cost something significant, and it's unconfirmed, it will start to update that. The point is not to assume that the prediction is always true. The point is to observe what happens and allow the prediction, allow the nervous system to have another data point. Now, one thing I want to name here, sometimes these experiments will reveal a clear relational pattern, the setting running exactly as described, right? I mean, you could do this with someone who you know won't take your honesty very well. And sometimes they reveal that the anxiety is less psychological than you thought, and that sleep, physiology, or something else is more primary. Both of these are useful information, by the way. The experiment is not a test whether the framework fits. It's a way of gathering data about your system and what it's actually doing. So this is what's important. Insight names the pattern, but experience and felt sense change it and revise it. The experiment is not about pushing through the fear. It's about generating new evidence, generating new data. So I'm going to leave you with three questions this week. The first is, which one of these resonated the most? The constant monitoring of the world, the being seen feeling dangerous, or full presence is too much? Again, these are adaptive predictions, not fixed structures. What has the setting been costing you over time? Not in the moment, but accumulated weight of it. And finally, which experiment are you willing to try this week? Not because it's going to fix anything, but it's going to help your nervous system begin to rewire. And the only way to create the evidence is through lived experience. Your anxiety is serving a purpose, and it's protecting you from outcomes it learned to expect in an environment that may not exist anymore. The work is not about arguing it out of protection. The work is about gathering new evidence so it can relax, so it can see the world as safe or welcoming, or that being seen is okay, that the protection isn't necessary at the same level of intensity. If you haven't taken the quiz yet, I wanted to call that out again, the Healing Archetype quiz. It will help, and part of this, in terms of this episode, it will help you learn if your physical system is at suboptimal capacity, right? And I do have a protocol for that, which I will be talking about on the show. It's called the Restoration Protocol. So if, my website has been redone. I have all of these up there except for Optimize the Vessel, which I'm still working on. But hopefully you've enjoyed the show. I really enjoyed putting it together, and I will see you next time.